Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC and WNYC.org. Just a reminder that in about 20 minutes, we're going to be doing our first segment in Brian Lehrer's, the Brian Lehrer Show's, Immigrant World Cup. Now, here's how it's going to work. We're going to pick a random World Cup match pitting two countries against each other and hear from New Yorkers with ties to those two countries. This afternoon, there's actually a game between Paraguay and Italy, and that's the matchup we're going to feature on this show. So if you're Italian or Paraguayan, we want to hear from you. Call in and boast, not just about soccer, but about your country. We want to hear about your music, your food, your community here in New York. Tell us why your country is the world champ. It's the first matchup in our Immigrant World Cup, Italy versus Paraguay, in 20 minutes. Get ready to call in to 212-433-9692 or post now to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show and tell us why Italy or Paraguay is the world champ in food, culture, or whatever you think it reigns in. In the meantime, we're going to talk all about hedge funds. And I'm so pleased now to be joined by Sebastian Mallaby. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a Washington Post columnist. He's a former bureau chief at The Economist magazine, and he has sat on the editorial board of The Washington Post. He writes all about international economics and globalization, and his new book is More Money Than God: Hedge Funds and the Making of a New Elite. He traces the history of hedge funds within the world of Wall Street and the role these firms play in our current economic troubles. Sebastian Mallaby, welcome to WNYC.
Great to be with you.
And I am going to learn a tremendous amount here because I've always wondered about hedge funds, but I have to admit I know very little about how they work. So you are going to educate me all in 20 minutes about this most important world of money. And I guess the very first question, what exactly is a hedge fund as compared especially to the big investment banks, investment funds, and the other financial institutions that we know so much more about?
Well, if you put five experts in a room and ask them how to define hedge funds, you probably get six or seven definitions. But the definition I go with goes back to the first hedge fund manager, Alfred Winslow Jones, who set up his fund in 1949, much earlier than people realized that hedge funds began. And he had basically four things he did which defined a hedge fund. The first was that he had a performance fee. So he claimed that Phoenician sea captains would keep 20% of their profits after a successful voyage. So he said, well, I'll take 20% too of the upside from the partners who put money in the fund. So that performance fee incentivized his portfolio managers to really hustle harder. Second thing he did was to keep a low profile. And he was very good at that because he'd been an undercover operative against the Nazis during the 1930s in Berlin. And he kept the secrecy thing going, you know, when he was running a hedge fund, and so he stayed off the radar and avoided regulation. Third thing he did was to go short as well as long. In other words, he bet against stocks as well as betting that they would go up. And then the fourth thing he did was to borrow money to expand his bets using what's called leverage. So those four things I take as the definition of what a hedge fund is.
And I love this part of the book. First of all, I had no idea that we were going back as far as 1949. And there's a wonderful black and white photograph of this rather eager, well-scrubbed, handsome fellow, which shocked me. I thought maybe 1980 would have been the first hedge fund fellow. But no, we go all the way back and you tell his history and this anti-Nazi undercover operative. It's very alluring. It would make for a wonderful movie and maybe you'll option it as well. But then you do break it down very nicely for lay people to understand, those of us who are not money thinkers. And as you say, as you define it, four features of the earliest hedge funds that continue to this day, performance fees. And you tried to bury this part, but we're going to talk about it. Avoiding regulatory red tape, preserving flexibility, and the invention of short selling. So let's, Sebastian, go through each, starting with the notion of the performance fee. It would be an understatement, I think a pretty huge one, to say that this performance fee structure has led to some pretty wealthy individuals, wouldn't it?
Well, I call the book More Money Than God for a reason. I mean, and you know, it goes back to 1913 when J.P. Morgan died, and he was known as Jupiter because of his godlike power over Wall Street. And when he died, basically in today's dollars, he had about $1.4 billion. Mm. Now, lots of hedge fund managers, not all of them, of course, but the sort of the top segment can easily make $1.4 billion in a year or 2 or 3 years. I mean, it's just extraordinary money, off the scales kind of money.
Wow.
So the incentive fee definitely creates an incentive, that's for sure.
All right. We want to encourage our listeners, the ones with $1.4 billion and the others, to call in. And we want to take your calls for Sebastian Mallaby of The Washington Post. If you've worked at a hedge fund, worked on Wall Street, or have any comments at all about the world of hedge funds, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692, or post on our comments page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. In particular, if you were at a hedge fund during the housing bubble burst or the subsequent economic collapse, we want to hear your perspective. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Now, Sebastian, how much do you fault the obscene payments in hedge funds with creating a culture in which Wall Streeters were willing to do whatever it takes, including cutting corners in order to make more than the next guy? I mean, the book, More Money Than God, and I love that title. It's terrific. But it does give the impression that everyone who isn't in a hedge fund is trying to get into one, and that the best way to do that is to do something pretty brazen.
I'm not sure about that. Actually, one of the things I like about hedge funds, and I think people in Congress could pay attention to this, is that they are incentivized both to make money and therefore to innovate, and that's the 20% profit share they get, but they're also incentivized to manage risk because, in general, hedge fund managers have their own money in the fund, and that's a difference. You asked me earlier, you know, how do you compare hedge funds to investment banks? Well, if you run a desk that takes risk inside an investment bank, you may have stock in the company, but that's a big company, and the stock could blow up because of what some guy in London does. So your incentive is to take as much risk as possible. If it works out, you get a big bonus. If you lose, then it's the shareholders' problem. But in hedge funds, you know, they are incentivized to manage the risk on the downside. And I think that's why, you know, you invited callers to call in about the housing, the mortgage bust. In 2007, hedge funds were up 10%, which is pretty good for a crisis, showing that they managed risk well. And more than that, the subgroup of hedge funds that was supposed to be managed, you know, investing in these subprime mortgages, that subgroup of asset-backed bond managers, they were flat for the year in 2007. So they totally dodged the bullet, basically because they were doing the research and managing the risk.
So it's fair to say that hedge fund managers have more skin in the game than other banks?
Exactly.
Especially in the lead-up to the financial crisis?
Exactly. I mean, hedge funds throughout their history have had more downside risk because it's their own money in the fund alongside that of their investors. And I think that's why they manage the risk. And we've got to remember that, you know, we can't just wish away financial risk. You know, currencies will go up and down. Interest rates will fluctuate. There will be difficult decisions about where to allocate scarce capital in a modern, sophisticated economy. I mean, basically, finance is a series of uncertain promises about an unknowable future. So there's risk. And the question is, not how do you get rid of risk, but who will manage that risk most effectively? And my conclusion, after looking at the history of hedge funds for 3 years, is that these guys actually do know how to manage risk. And so, you know, maybe the future of finance lies in the history of hedge funds.
When you went and you have some advice for lawmakers, as you suggested earlier, and we're going to come back to that when we button up at the end. But when you went into writing the book, did you have a hypothesis? Did you have a reason for writing the book, or were you open to any possibility?
I began with two sort of motives when I began writing. The first was that everything about finance and about the world economy is sort of on the internet. It's all open stuff. And the last frontier of secrecy seemed to be these hedge funds, which were so secretive. And that was just an, you know, irresistible attraction for a reporter. The other thing was that I did think there was a double standard, right? That on the one hand, if four quantitative people start up a small boutique company on the West Coast, everybody loves it because it's doing software. If four quantitative people start up a little boutique company on the East Coast, people hate it because it's a hedge fund. So my going-in hypothesis was this double standard seems a bit weird. So I did have a bias towards kind of trying to challenge the conventional wisdom, which is that hedge funds are always evil, always doing everything wrong. And I must say, after 3 years of research, I'm convinced that the going in bias was correct.
All right. Well, let's talk then about, as I promised you I would, regulation. We talked about the performance fee. That's point one. Avoiding regulatory red tape, the next feature, which is bound to be the one that gets our listeners rankled and riled up. You write that consciously avoiding regulation was one of the initial hallmarks of hedge funds. And isn't the lesson of the last 3 years, from the mortgage meltdown through the Bernie Madoff mess, which of course is a bit different, but now we have the BP thing, consciously avoiding regulation, isn't that a recipe for disaster, even with all that you've said about hedge funds thus far?
You know, it's a totally fair question, and I'm not against regulation. I'm in favor of large parts of this bill in Congress to do more financial regulation, but I think we have to be realistic about what regulation can and cannot achieve. Because actually, in the lead up, you know, one of the things we learn from this crisis is that multiple regulators applying multiple different sets of rules in multiple countries, all of them missed the crisis. So it doesn't matter if it's the financials, the FSA in London, which was a well-regarded regulator there, or the Fed in the US, or continental European regulators, or the SEC in the US, or the CFTC. Nobody came out of this well. And when multiple regulators using different sets of rules, you know, all fall flat on their face, we shouldn't give up on regulation, of course not. But we should be realistic about how much it can achieve and try to shift some of the burden for avoiding the next crisis into putting the risk someplace where people have the incentive to manage it properly, even if the regulators can't be everything that we wish they would be.
Well, I guess I should ask a nuts and bolts question. Why are hedge funds allowed to exist with a much lower level of regulation than regular investment funds?
Well, the way that Alfred Winslow Jones achieved this back in the 50s when he began was basically he didn't market the fund publicly. And if you didn't market it publicly, then you would be a private investment vehicle. And under that, you could get some exemption from the 1940 Investment Act. And so what he would do is that he would just basically invite people over to dinner and say, are you happy with your investments? And if they weren't, he would take some money for them. And it was very much word of mouth, meaning in between mouthfuls at his dinner table.
All right, let's take a call from Richard in Manhattan. See, I learned something right there, Sebastian. I'm so glad we have you here. Richard in Manhattan, you're on WNYC.
Yes, hi.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Just a quick question. At what point do these hedge funds become, their investments and their bets become a self-fulfilling prophecy because of their reputation and the amount of money they invest? They sort of drive the market in the direction they're anticipating and other people follow. Where does free market leave off and where does manipulation begin?
That's a really great and totally legitimate question, because it is true that, of course, investment strategies can be self-fulfilling if everybody else piles on doing the same thing that you're doing. You're going to be looking like a genius and making money just because the weight of the money coming right behind you will drive up your positions. And this has happened, and in my book I describe some episodes. For example, in 1993, a sort of pretty intense trader called Michael Steinhardt, who was known to light up two cigarettes at once when things got tough in his trading room, you know, he made absolutely fantastic profits. And there's a great vignette, you know, he's taken a few days to be in the Caribbean and he's relaxing there, and he'd get his office to call in every day. And one day they call up and said, you know, Mike, you made $1 billion today. I mean, it was that kind of, or maybe it was slightly, I've forgotten the exact number, but it was an absurd amount of money. And this was exactly what you're describing, the weight of money coming behind him. But the thing is, you can also blow up if you do that, because sooner or later, when money flows one way, if the only thing driving up your investments is weight of money, that won't last forever. The trend will turn. And in fact, the year after that happened, Michael Steinhardt did blow up. He lost one third of his fund. And so it's a dangerous strategy. And these guys at hedge funds know that. And therefore, they're pretty well incentivized to avoid purely basing their strategies on what everybody else is going to do.
Richard, does that answer your question?
It certainly does. And I think I'm going to take a look at that book.
It's a terrific book. Thank you so much, Richard,
great,
for calling.
Thank you.
I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. And my guest is Sebastian Mallaby, senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations. His book is More Money Than God. And I want to continue with the key features of hedge funds. Another one you write, Sebastian, is reliance on flexibility and complexity. And for instance, you talk about short selling, essentially invested, you write, in the hedge fund world. Invented in the hedge fund world.
It's actually not true that shorting was invented in the hedge fund world. Shorting, in particularly in futures markets for commodities, goes back way back in history.
Let's take another step back from that. What is shorting? For those who know nothing about how the markets work, and then explain how it works in the hedge fund setting.
Sure. So when you short a stock or a bond or anything else, what you do is you borrow it first, and then you sell it. So you're borrowing something you don't own. You're selling something you don't own. And the idea is that if it falls in value, you buy it back later at a lower price and give it back to the person you borrowed it from, and you've made a profit on that fall in the meantime. Now, so shorting has been around for a long time, but the brilliance of the first hedge fund manager, A.W. Jones, was to combine the shorting with leverage. Because his idea was, look, I don't know if the S&P 500 will go up or down, but I do have some views on which particular stocks, which particular companies are well managed. So I will be long some companies, i.e. I will bet that they're going up, short some other companies, so I'll bet that they'll go down. So my total exposure to the S&P 500 index, to the broad market, is zero or anyway quite small. So I've hedged out that market risk. That's why I'm a hedged fund. So now, because I've hedged out that kind of risk, I can take more of the risk I want, which is the risk that my particular stock selections are correct. So his idea was, you know, if you hedge out one sort of risk, you can take more of the risk you actually know about.
So less gambling and more intelligent investing.
Right. It's the isolation of a particular risk or a particular characteristic of a security that you have a strong conviction about.
So if we buy the premise that people within the hedge funds know what they're doing with this complexity, do we have to consider what happens when the complexity falls into the wrong hands, so to speak? One of the major storylines of the financial collapse was that lots of people didn't even understand the instruments they were using.
Again, but if you go and look at who didn't understand the instruments that they were using, it wasn't really hedge funds because, I mean, of course, there are exceptions to any statement right here, right? So there were hedge funds that blew up in 2000, 2007, 2008. But on the whole, they were up 10% in 2007. That's pretty good in a crisis. And in 2008, they were down, but down half as much as the broad market average.
But there's a trickle-down effect, if you will. There's a perpetuation of a culture that is filtering its way into the rest of the market, isn't there?
I'm not sure about that. I think that the culture which is toxic is the culture of too big to fail and traders' options. Too big to fail means I'll take so much risk, I don't care because the taxpayers will bail me out. I mean, that's grotesque. I mean, that means that no ordinary taxpayers are bailing out and backstopping the risks taken at big financial companies. And that is horrific, right? But between 2000 and 2009, 5,000 hedge funds did go under. They went out of business. And not a single one was too big to fail. They all got zero from the taxpayers. So I think, you know, hedge funds are not guilty of that particularly unattractive part of financial culture.
You wrote in the Wall Street Journal that, quote, as well as struggling to tame financial behemoths, this gets back to our issue of Congress that I promised you we would return to, Congress should promote boutique risk takers. So you really think Washington should promote risk taking?
My argument is that you can't get rid of financial risk. It's there. I mean, you know, currencies will go up and down, as I said before. Interest rates will fluctuate, and finance is uncertain. And there's always been crashes. There were, you know, financial bubbles and financial crashes going back to the tulip mania in 17th century Holland. And that was way before hedge funds. Hedge funds may go back quite a long way, but not that far. So the point is that there will be risk, and we have to ask ourselves, A, who can manage that risk intelligently, and B, who will do it without putting taxpayers on the hook? And my answer is that hedge funds pass both those tests, which is why I think that, you know, we should encourage more of them.
Too small to fail, you say at one point. Brian recently had Arthur Brooks of the American Enterprise Institute here on the show. And the premise of his new book is that the new culture war is not about abortion. It's not about marriage or gay marriage or values. But it's all about economic issues, and that we're at a moment where we're rethinking the very premise of free market capitalism. What say you to that?
I think it's interesting. I mean, there's been a number of people who have come out with books pointing to the rise of state capitalism in countries like China. To some extent, you know, it's done by the oil price. When the oil price goes up, you know, the countries that tend to have big state sectors because they've got nationalized oil industries do better. And so it looks as if this state model of capitalism is working better. So there's a China effect and oil effect. My own sense, though, is that governments, you know, that the kind of basic lessons of the fall of the Berlin Wall are not wrong. I mean, that governments need to regulate, but they shouldn't be making all the decisions in the economy. And so I think that we'll be back to seeing the virtues of markets not too far in the future.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Sebastian Mallaby, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, columnist at the Washington Post. His new book is More Money Than God, Hedge Funds and the Making of a New Elite. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer. Up next, it's time for our first matchup in the Immigrant World Cup, Italy versus Paraguay. If you are Italian or Paraguayan, or even if you've just been to either or both countries, start calling us now. Tell us about why your nation is the best. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We're going to ask you to boast about the food, the music, the natural beauty, and yes, maybe even a little bit about soccer. But any and all Italians or Paraguayans, give us a call now. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692.